Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on this Monday morning, October the 25th, 2021. 14 and a half minutes past the hour, and we've got a great show for you today. Don't forget when we go off the air this morning at 10:10 a.m., mid-morning coffee break with Adam Lepp will follow this program. And we've got the big event coming up on Thursday night, which we will tell you more about in the next hour. We're going to start the show this morning with a very fun interview, because there is a great new book out. If you live in Ohio, of course you know the name Joe Nuxall, legendary Reds broadcaster, player. He is a legend in the state of Ohio. There is a new book out, which I had the chance to get last week, and I have not been able to put it down. It is fantastic. Joe Nuxall, The Old Left-Hander and Me, My Conversations with Joe Nuxall About the Reds, Baseball, and Broadcasting, written by author and journalist John Kiesewetter. John, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you, Scott?
Good to speak with you. John, how did this book come about?
So when I worked at the Enquirer, the Cincinnati Enquirer, for 40 years, last 30 as TV columnist. And when I left and joined Cincinnati Public Radio, the NPR affiliate in town, WPXU, I just knew I wanted to write a book of some sort. And I was going over all the material that I'd had with all the interviews with Joe Nuxall over about a 20-year period before I passed in 2007. And realized that I just had a lot of unique material that hadn't been known. Plus, he did his own book in 2004. And when I got that book, I was a little disappointed, because I would love to go here and speak to the Knights of Columbus or Rotary groups or whatever. And he told me fun stories about his playing days and players he knew in the 50s and the 60s. They want a book. So I thought, well, let's collect these stories, preserve them, and pass them on to a generation. And so that's when I started this process about 4 years ago.
John, when did you first meet Joe Nuxall?
I first met him in person, in spring of 1986. He's from Hamilton. I grew up in Middletown, which is on the other end of Butler County, just north of Cincinnati. And as a young kid, he was my favorite player. I was left-handed. He was left-handed. He was a pitcher who, when he came back to the Reds in 1962, he was 5-0. The next year, he was 15-8. So over a 20-year span, he was 20-8. And he was my favorite player. I finally got to meet him in the 80s when I was TV critic and actually did a big long feature on The Old Left-Hander that ran back then in 1986. The Enquirer had its own Sunday magazine, kind of like Family Weekly or whatever you get in the paper today. And so I did a nice long feature about Joe. And like I said, as TV radio columnist, I covered him and would keep up with him for about 21 years before he passed.
For people who might not know Joe Nuxall, 14 years have passed since his passing in 2007. Who was he, and why was he important to Ohio?
Two reasons. One, he holds the major league record for being the youngest player to pitch in the big leagues back during the war, when the war depleted baseball rosters. As a 15-year-old kid, he pitched for the Reds on June 10th, 1944, a few days after D-Day, and he held that record all of his life, and I don't think that record's going to be broken. And then he returned to the Reds as a pitcher after 7 years in the minors and played from 1952 to 1966. He was a two-time All-Star in 55 and 56. He led the National League in shutouts in 1955. He was part of a 1956 Reds team that tied the National League record for most home runs by a ball club. He hit two, but on that club was Ted Kaczynski, the great first baseman, Frank Robinson's rookie year, a couple outfielders named Gus Bell, who's the grandfather of David Bell, the current Reds manager, father of Buddy Bell, who was a popular Cleveland Indians player for a long time. And then he became the Reds broadcaster in 1967, and he spent most of his career, he worked with a couple of different announcers, including Al Michaels' first big league job was in Cincinnati from 71 to 73, and then he hooked up with, they hired Marty Brenneman, a young announcer from Virginia, Marty, who's been given the Frick Award, is in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and the two of them were just hugely popular, not just during the 70s when you had the Big Red Machine and the back-to-back World Series championships, but even better in the 80s when all the stars had left and Marty and Joe were doing the games on radio and people tuned in to listen to them and listen to their stories and the fun they had on the air when the team lost 100 games and they got better as broadcasters as when the team was bad. But the two of them paired together and did games all 162 through the 2004 season. Joe kind of semi-retired, but continued to broadcast until through his last year of 2007. So he was well known for his feats as a pitcher, for his record-breaking appearance back in 1944, but also with Marty Brenneman as Marty and Joe on the radio for so many years.
When we look at Joe Nupsall's career, much like a John Madden or Jimmy Johnson, people who have a career on the field, those two as managers, and then they go to the booth, some people get better known for their broadcasting career than their managerial or playing career. Certainly, I think that's the case with John Madden. Was that the case with Joe Nupsall? Did more people know him as a broadcaster because he did it for so long?
I'm going to guess so, because his broadcasting career, in terms of length, eclipsed his playing career. And because, like I said, once he paired up with Marty Brenneman, and the two of them became so hugely popular down here, not just because of the winning record, the dominant Big Red Machine, but because they were just so fun to listen to when the Reds were bad in the 80s, and then they went to the World Series in the 90s. Another thing that made Joe Nupsall unique was that the day he retired in spring training in 1967 and joined the Reds booth, and the next day he did the game, but also the next day he pitched batting practice. And he pitched batting practice for about 20 years from 1967 into the late 1980s after Pete Rose had come back and broken Ty Cobb's hit record in 1985. He was still pitching batting practice. And you think when you watch the baseball playoffs now or know of broadcasters who have moved to the booth, whether it's Jim Palmer, Bob Gibson, Don Drysdale, Ron Darling, so many people, even Herb Score, all those guys did ball games, but they didn't pitch batting practice before they and keep their hand in the game as Joe did. And in the book, both Johnny Bench and George Foster, great Reds players for the Big Red Machine of the 70s, said he was a very important part of the Big Red Machine because when they were facing a tough lefty, Steve Carlton or Randy Jones or somebody, having a former major league pitcher who's left-handed pitch batting practice was a big asset, and they could look for the release point coming out of a left-hander's arm, and he could place the ball about anywhere. He had very good control at that point. They wanted it high, low, inside, outside. And he was a real big asset to the Big Red Machine by pitching batting practice.
When it comes to the Ford C. Frick Award, which they give to broadcasters in the Baseball Hall of Fame, as you say, Marty Brenneman has won it. A lot of the greats have won it. There's always been talk, and even during his life, why hasn't Joe Nuxall won this? What's your opinion on that?
I don't think it's ever going to happen. There's when you think of to the way broadcasting booths today are structured, with two or three guys that do TV, plus a different two, or possibly three, who do radio, times 30 major league clubs that's in the present, and then the recent past or the distant past, there's just way too many people that might be deserving of the honor that he would be considered. Secondly, he was known regionally, or what we call here Reds country, in Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, and he wasn't known nationally. And he wasn't known nationally for doing any broadcasting when the Reds went to the World Series in 75 and 76. The Reds GM, Dick Wagner, made the decision that Marty Brenneman would be the representative on the NBC and CBS broadcast networks teams, not Joe Nuxall. So he's known, very well known, I'd say beloved, out here in Reds country, but beyond the reach of the WLW signal and the Reds radio affiliates. He's not known at all, except for his, baseball accomplishments.
And to put this in perspective, when the Reds had some really good teams in the early 90s, it is said that people would turn the World Series games on their television and turn the volume down and turn the volume up on their radio to listen to Marty and Joe. This was a fairly common occurrence, was it not?
This has been the way it's been in Cincinnati. Has always been a very big radio market. And yes, people have listened to Marty and Joe's call of Reds games and turn down the sound on TV. It extends well beyond that, because if you're at Great American Ballpark and they'll replay a highlight like the last out of the 1990 World Series, the ball that Todd Benziger caught in foul territory, or Pete Rose's record-breaking hit, 4,192, they have the TV video, but over it they've put Marty and Joe's call, radio call, on it, and that's what you see at Great American Ballpark. If you go to the Reds Hall of Fame and Museum next to the ballpark, most of the video clips are from the Reds TV network, but with the radio audio of Marty and Joe over it, and the TV guy was kind of erased from history.
When it comes to broadcasting, was he a proficient broadcaster? He certainly was entertaining. He certainly did a lot of things up there that were very entertaining for the crowd in the stadium. There are a lot of great pictures. But was he a proficient broadcaster?
Yeah, in his own way. I mean, he wasn't. He didn't sound like a college-educated professional announcer with the golden tones and multi-hyphenated words to describe a play, but he called the play fairly, and with enthusiasm. But I kind of liken it to if your dad, your grandfather, your uncle was calling a game, who loved the game, loved the team, and knew it inside out. Occasionally he'd get confused, and he even joked at times that he could call a ball to right, left, center field, some, like Harry Carey, he could mispronounce the names. There was one time in the Santa, they brought up Cecil Espy, and he kept on calling it Epsy, putting the P before the S, and the radio engineer told me that somebody in the green seats at Riverfront Stadium beneath the radio booth shouted up there and says, "Joe, it's Epsy." Or Espy. But he, in his own way, and he For many years, he did a pregame interview with a player or a coach or something, and then in the postgame, he started a game show for probably 20 years. And his questions could be convoluted, but they always were good ball questions that generally get very good answers from the man who he was interviewing, whether it was I guess Ted had retired, but then to Tom Seaver or Bench or Foster or Joe Morgan or whoever it might have been that he was, Barry Lark would have been interviewing at the time. But he always got great answers out of them, despite some sometimes convoluted questions.
Being a fan of Joe Nuxall as a player, as you were, when you first met him, what was the man like?
He was the nicest, most gracious person, down to earth, just a regular Joe. Barney Brenneman tells a story. He had a cancer scare in like 1992, and Marty went to visit Joe, and Joe saw there were these flowers in the hospital room and cards all over the place, and Joe, you know, didn't understand why there was this outpouring of sympathy and support from people he didn't know. And Marty looked at him and says, "You don't get it, do you?" So he didn't know or realize how beloved he was. I mean, Marty has said that he's never heard anybody say a bad thing about Joe Nuxall in all the years he knew him. And he would always stop and chat with the fans. He didn't mind having his dinner interrupted to sign some autographs. He had a wonderful recall for names. He could remember the name of somebody he had met a couple of years before or many years before or played golf with, and he'd run into him later and say, "How you doing?" And how's X, Y, and Z, who were part of the golf foursome at that point. When the West Side Little Leaguers went to I don't know if they made it to the World Series or had advanced and done well, the West Side Hamilton, and they came back and they had a big thing for him, and there were lots of dignitaries and politicians there, and they were looking for Joe. Joe wasn't with the politicians. He wasn't with the dignitaries of the city of Hamilton. He was over sitting with the kids on the baseball team talking baseball. I mean, he was just a real common man who was beloved.
And John, is it also true, because there was a story for many, many years that you could find Joe every morning at Bob Evans in the Cincinnati area, Hamilton area, and at the height of his career, you knew where to find him if you wanted to get an autograph or say something to him. He was there every morning.
He ate breakfast every day at the Bob Evans on Route 4 in Fairfield, which has since closed. He was there so often and was such a regular customer that they actually put a bronze plaque, and he always sat at the counter with his son Kim and three, four, or five friends. They had breakfast every morning, and they actually put a bronze plaque on the seat at the counter where he sat in, and when the store was closing, the chair was given to Kim, his son, and he has it. But yeah, in his last 3 or 4 years, whenever I needed to interview him, I'd call Kim, and Kim would say, "Well, just meet us at Bob Evans about 8 o'clock," and I'd come in, and Kim would usually be sitting next to Joe, and he'd get up, and so I could sit down next to his dad, and we'd just sit there and talk while he had his Bob Evans breakfast.
What was his feeling toward reporters?
He was gracious with everyone, and willingly gave of his time, and pretty candid. There's only one person he didn't like from all the research I did, and he got along with everyone. The only one was. And I'm going to go blank on his name. Rogers Hornsby. Rogers Hornsby was the great Cardinals hitter, player, manager, won some World Series for the Cardinals, came to the Reds as a manager in 50, 51, 52, I guess, and Joe was there at the time, Rogers, according to Joe, Rogers thought everybody should be able to hit 340 like he did. But what really, why Joe really didn't like him was that if you were pitching and it came time for the to make a pitching change, Rogers Hornsby didn't go to the mound, take the ball, and bring in the new pitcher. Hornsby stood in the dugout and waved to the bullpen for the pitcher to come in. And Mark said, I just stand there like an idiot holding the ball, doing nothing on the mound, waiting for the reliever to get to the mound. So he just didn't like Hornsby's lack of protocol and some other issues that he and the team had with Hornsby. Hornsby apparently liked to use the shower as his urinal, and the players obviously didn't like that. But there was a number of issues that Joe didn't like Rogers Hornsby. But other than that, I couldn't find anyone that he spoke ill about or who spoke ill of him. And I never encountered anything about him not getting along with other reporters, other broadcasters, anyone.
Now, I have the book that Joe did in 2004, and I have your book, and I love your book. And one of the places where your book differs from that book, and I think it's just the true story of it, is what happened to Joe at the end of his career with the Cincinnati Reds. In 2002, he said 2004 would be his last season. In his book, that's treated as, pretty much I'm just getting on and I want to do other things. But that really wasn't what was going on.
Kim told me that I didn't discuss it with Joe, but I had long conversations with Kim, as well as Joe's widow, Donzetta, and their other son, Phil, and Marty Brenneman, among others. I think I interviewed about 50 people for this book. Kim says that Nuxhall, Joe's dying day, thought it was the owner at the time, Carl Lindner, who was basically forcing him out, wanting him to reduce his schedule and leave. His book from 2004 with Greg Hoard talked about, he'd fallen asleep in the booth a couple times and he was getting up in age. And Kim told me that, yes, his dad wanted to cut back on his schedule. In fact, he had told me back when his contract was up in it was either 92 or 96, that he'd like to do fewer road games. He got tired of the road, sitting in the hotel, waiting for all the travel, living out of a hotel room, etc. But he definitely loved doing the games, and it wasn't his choice. And in fact, when it came out, when his book came out, there was a book signing at the public library in downtown Cincinnati. And Joe, at that point, told his side of the story that he thought he was being forced out, but it wasn't John Allen. And of course, the only person above John Allen at that point was Carl Lindner. But he wouldn't say that specifically. And there was a big firestorm of bad negative publicity, and almost immediately, I think the very next day, the Reds announced, there was a misunderstanding, and Joe will be back for some games in 2005. And in fact, he did games in 2005, 2006, and 2007 on a periodic basis with Marty. And so his retirement wasn't firm in 2004. And Joe, when I talked to him in spring of 07, he was just absolutely thrilled he was going to be part of the opening day broadcast in 2007, because opening day is like a national holiday down here in Cincinnati, as Reds fans know.
Joe Nuxhall had many health battles over the years, especially the last 20 years. How did you see those, and how did you see those as you talked with him? Did you see that in him?
He was so resilient. When I'd see him and talk to him, he just sounded like regular Joe. In fact, even his wife said, you know, and after he passed, you know, going looking at the second bathroom in their home here in Fairfield, found, you know, pain medication, other medication that he wasn't taking, that he was just going to tough it through, as he had repeated battles with cancer in the last 5 years of his life. He had a bad knee that he'd kind of wobble at times until he had it replaced. But he was he physically and mentally, spiritually, was just the same old Joe, the same good old Joe. All the times I'd see him, and whenever I would see him out in public, but not speak to him.
What was the mood of your last conversation? Did you think it would be your last conversation?
No, I didn't. He had a recurrence of cancer that required him to be hospitalized and miss part of the spring training broadcast in spring of 2007. So this was February 2007. And he died in November of that year. But my conversation, it was a long conversation because in April, Kim, his son, had announced what was called the Joe Hope Project. And it was an umbrella of several different proposals. Most of them have come to fruition. One was to build a Miracle League field here in Fairfield for the developmentally handicapped ball. And that was built, but it wasn't built, it didn't open, I don't think, till 2011 or 2012. They wanted to start a rookie success league with the Reds have done in many different communities to get young kids from low income to come to play baseball and teach them life values. And then there was a, they wanted to build an indoor gymnasium so that, again, kids, particularly developmentally disabled, developmentally disadvantaged, would have a place to exercise and have fun year-round. And that's the one piece that hasn't been built yet. All the others had. So anyway, there's this big Joe Hope project to raise a lot of money and get this launched. And that happened in early April. And Bob Castellini, the Reds owner, was there. Marty Brenneman, lots of some former players. And so this was the big initiative. And I kept on asking him. I said, well, why do you do this? He says, well, it's for the kids. Why? How did you get? You know, he used to do baseball clinics back in the 50s, in the off season, and in the 60s. And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Well, just for the kids. You know, if you give kids, you know, opportunity and education, they'll be good citizens when they grow up." And I would kept asking him the different, you know, his involvement with different things. And the other thing that he started down here was in 1985. He started a scholarship fund in which scholarships for $1,000 or $2,000 were given to one or two kids who were high school seniors throughout Butler County here, Fairfield, Middletown, Monroe, the Lakota School District, Oxford, Tonawanda, Ross. And that's continued to this day, 14 years after his passing, that they've given out now since in 36 years, almost $900,000 in college scholarships to in the name of Joe Nexall, who never went to a day of college. And so that's also part of his legacy down here that they were trying to cement with this Joe Hope dinner in April of 2007. And so we talked at length about that, and that's when it came up that he was going to be part of opening day, and he was just thrilled because from 52 till 2007, he had only missed one opening day, and that was in 1961 after the Reds had traded him to Kansas City Athletics. But he was back with the – and I guess he missed – and then he was back with the team in 62.
2007 was a very interesting year. He was still giving interviews. He was still doing some broadcasting. He was still doing charity events. Did the chicken dance. There's a very famous video, and I think from that fall, he did the chicken dance. So even though he had this active cancer, he was still doing things. I think even his last week, he was out on the golf course with Marty Brenneman for a charity event in which I think two guys had won a contest or a bid for charity.
Right.
That week he was out there. What happened?
Well, and a photo from that, Marty Brenneman had given me the photo that was taken with him and Joe on the golf course. Somebody at a charity auction had won a playing golf round with Marty and Joe, and Joe was too weak to play. But he would get out of the cart and hit a ball occasionally on several different holes, but basically just kind of held court in the golf cart, telling stories to these guys who had won this opportunity to be with him. And when they got back at the clubhouse at the ninth hole, after the ninth hole, Marty said, "Wait, I know you're not doing well. Why don't I take you to your car and get you home?" And Joe said, "No. He was committed to fulfilling this obligation, and this was like 3 or 4 days before he passed. And on about the 14th hole, Marty and Joe were sitting together in the golf cart, and Joe said, we really had a fun time, didn't we?" And Marty said he kind of choked up because he realized that this was Joe's way of saying that, "I'm probably never going to see you again." And a day or two later, he went to the hospital, and that he died a couple of days after that. Marty told me that Joe intuitively knew that he was very near the end of his life, and that this was going to be the last time they'd see each other.
When you heard that he had passed away, what was the feeling? I know that obituaries were being planned because it was pretty aware that he wasn't doing very well. But that day in November when the word came, how did you get the word, first of all?
I turned on the radio, and when I woke up to my clock radio, I heard it on the local news. I showered, got cleaned up as quick as I could, and went immediately to the Bob Evans. And there was his group that he usually had breakfast with, and I interviewed some of them for some comments about their friend Joe, and to try to get, because I figured there's going to be plenty of people. There'll be the Reds officials, there'll be the former teammates, there'll be the broadcasting team, there'll be the Reds players, past and present, his teammate. But I just wanted to get some of the real people that he, were his close friends, or people, some of the workers at Bob Evans who served him, just to kind of talk about Joe Nuxall, the person.
The funeral, or at least the visitation. The visitation, I believe the funeral was private. The visitation was something not to be believed.
It was amazing. It was in what's called the arena at Fairfield High School, which is the big basketball stadium. You enter at one end, and you literally had to walk around the entire court before you got to the casket and Don Zetta and Kim and Joe. And as you walked around, there were tables and displays of Joe, of his some plaques, pictures, jerseys, gloves, memorabilia, or whatever, so people could absorb different parts of this information and see this different stuff about Joe's life before they got to meet the family. And the line went out the door, up the hill to the entrance of the high school, and looped back several times. I was people in line. I mean, there was Nick Clooney, George's father, the actor, singer, newsman, Bob Trumpy, and many friends, people who disrespected him throughout the area. And they cut off the line at 8 o'clock, and I went back at 10 o'clock just so I could call the newspaper and say the last people came in the door, whatever. And the line was so long, they cut it off at 8 o'clock, and that the last people who spoke to the Nuxall family's last people in line were actually the janitorial staff at the high school, and that was about 10 after 11 by the time they got up to the Nuxall family. It was just an amazing scene that Marty said that Joe, if he would have been looking down on it, was certainly to be amazed at all the people that were there that day.
John, you had said that Joe was very candid with journalists. Was there ever something over the years when he was alive that he said that you thought, because you're a fan of his, you're a friend of his, that I can't print this? This won't come off well.
No, honestly not. But there were things that he'd be guarded about that he didn't get into great detail or just wouldn't talk about. One would be Marge Schott. I wrote a chapter about Pete and Marge. Joe had great frustrations with Marge. In fact, several people said, including the guy who produced their Kroger TV commercials, said, Joe just didn't like her. And they were greatly frustrated with her when it came time for contract renewal for the radio contract. Actually, Marty went public one time when their contracts were up. Said, we had a deal with John L., a general manager, and then she was balking at it. And he goes, I don't know who we're dealing with. And went public on WLW, the flagship station, that morning, saying that if we don't have contracts by the end of the season, which was like 10 days away, we'll leave. And that very public blast got it off dead center and got them their contracts renewed. But he was guarded with me about talking with Marge, although he talked to others, and others knew that he was not a real big fan of Marge. But he was smart enough not to say it to the press. On the other hand, Joe was pretty supportive of players, all players, and Joe, whereas Marty was more critical than Joe. But there was one famous incident back, and I think it was 2002, which Barry Larkin, the now Hall of Famer shortstop, didn't get to a ball or didn't field a ball in the hole, and he said on the air, Larkin is losing it. Well, that lit up the press, and Larkin wasn't happy, and his manager wasn't happy. But it turned. We knew that in spring training he had injured a thigh muscle, an inner thigh muscle, and he was apparently still suffering from the effects of it. And in fact, a day or two later, went back on the disabled list. But it was just a moment of candor of Joe on the air telling the listeners what was actually going on in the field. And they later talked about it and made it up and all. But if there's one thing that Nux is going to be remembered for, it was all the funny stories he would tell after dinner banquets or to the Knights of Columbus. That's where I first saw him, back in 1986. And it was kind of like Joe unplugged. And he'd tell these wonderfully funny stories about his playing days or players he knew for like an hour and a half without any notes. I mean, he just was an amazing storyteller. And when I didn't see those in his book that you've mentioned a couple of times, that was really the impetus. I said, I've got to collect these stories and get these. And so the whole first chapter is all these great funny stories that he told that I thought should be passed down to Reds fans forever.
When it comes to Pete Rose, you say he was also guarded about that issue.
Yeah, he was. I didn't talk to him directly about Pete, but in interviews, particularly, he did a series on of interviews near his retirement on WCET, the public TV station here in Cincinnati, and he made it clear that he was a Pete Rose fan until his book came out, admitting that he bet on baseball. And it happened to come out right when the Hall of Fame class was announced and kind of took the spotlight away from the next Hall of Fame class and was on Pete instead. And his finally, after writing, I think, two or three books denying that he bet on baseball, Linda said that he did. And Joe, being the baseball lover and knowing that rule's been above the door on the clubhouse, you know, since Commissioner Landis put it there about not betting on baseball. And Joe felt that, you know, when he finally admitted it, that changed his opinion in support of Pete.
John, what's your favorite story in regard to Joe Nuxall?
One of my favorites was one he told about Ted Kluszewski, the Big Reds first baseman. Joe had quite a temper as a player, and he had walked the bases loaded. He was like 2-0 on the batter when Clue calls timeout and comes over from first base to starts to the mound to say some words of support. And Joe turns around and waves him away and says, no, go back and play first base. I'm doing the pitching. And he said, Clue just started and said, oh, yeah? When you gonna start? So it was you know, just that's one of my favorite. The other was, we probably don't have time to get into, but they love to play pranks on each other in the booth, and I did a whole chapter on the pranks that Marty and Joe would play on each other, largely that Marty would play on Joe off the air in the booth. And they were fun to listen to on the air, but off the air, they were having a great time, too, that I've kind of pulled back the curtain on and let people enjoy the lovely relationship those two guys had.
We have about 5 minutes left here, and I do want to mention the book title again. Joe Nuxall, The Old Left-Hander and Me, My Conversations with Joe Nuxall About the Reds, Baseball, and Broadcasting. John, how can people get this book?
They can order it from my website. It's pretty easy. It's www.tvkeys. TVKIESE.com. That's what they called me down at the Cincinnati Inquirer when I would cover the TV beat. The cost is $20, and of the $20, I'm giving $1 to the Nuxall Foundation. And so I've sold, in just 5 weeks, I've sold about 1,500 books. So that's $1,500 I'm going to be given to the Nuxall Foundation. If you order it through the website, there's a $5 handling charge. It covers the mail, basically. But I sign each book, and I'll mail it out as quickly as I can. If you're in the Cincinnati area, it's also at the bookstore in Cincinnati called Joseph Beth Booksellers, and it's at the Reds Hall of Fame. The Reds Hall of Fame and gift shop has sold several hundred copies, too.
John, as you have said, Joe was a regional figure. He was an Ohio figure. He, you know, had that. 1,500 books in this amount of time, that has to surprise you.
Yes, it did. When I signed a book to his son, Kim, I said, hopefully, at the Nuxall Foundation banquet next year, I can give you a check for $1,000. That was my goal. But it just tells you how beloved Joe is, how he's not just remembered, but he's beloved. And like I said, it's been next month it'll be 14 years since he passed. He was so kind to everyone. He was so well known and beloved as a entertaining half of the Marty and Joe on radio team. And like I said, I've talked to an awful lot of people, and I've not heard of anybody ever say a bad word about Joe or an encounter with him. He's always gave of his time, always willing to, you know, particularly to talk to kids, but to sign an autograph or chat about baseball with anybody and everybody.
John, we have about 2 minutes left here. Not necessarily a story or anything that he told, but in all the conversations you had with him over breakfast about very tough subjects, is there something in your mind, a moment that sticks out to you about who this man was and what your relationship with him was?
He was always, I see him periodically, and well, I guess with my relationship with him, I don't think he treated me any differently because I was, quote, press, unquote. He was just so nice and kind with everyone. And he was a figure that we'd see around town because I live here in the same town with him, Fairfield. One of my favorite stories in the book was that when Santa would come to light the Christmas tree in front of City Hall, then Santa went inside City Council chambers and passed out candy canes. And Joe would be there too and pass out candy canes and listen to the kids and talk to each kid. Came through as Santa. And I snuck up behind him once when I brought my boys there, and I said, "Joe, can I get beer?" And he thought I was serious. He said, no, the kids shouldn't see me drinking. But by the look in his eye, he really wanted a Budweiser.
And this really is a great, great book. Everybody will enjoy this. I have the Joe Nutsall book for 2004, and this is great.
Well, thank you a lot. I've heard great feedback. I mean, Marty Brenneman said that, you know, if you love Joe as much as I did, you'll love this book. I thought that was high praise. But even my friends who are baseball fans have told me they just, you know, have loved the nostalgia, have loved the funny stories that they did. You know, they thought they knew a lot about Nuts, and it turns out they didn't, and they're enjoying to learn more about him.
And that's the insight that this book gives, and that's what makes it great. Joe Nutsall, The Old Left-Hander and Me, hey, the holiday season is not far off. What a great present for any baseball, broadcasting, or fan of Ohio, and certainly the Cincinnati Reds. John, thank you so much, and congratulations on all this success.
Thank you, Scott. This has been wonderful.
Take care. Bye-bye.
John Kieswetter. The author of this book, Joe Nutsall, The Old Left-Hander and Me, and I have some stories to tell about Joe Nutsall in the next hour. We'll be back in about 10 minutes.
That would happen. They wish I would have a part of it, and I could go to heaven and tell my Lord about it.